Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator, and this week my guest is the writer Julian Sancton, whose extraordinary new book is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. And it's one of those wonderfully resonant stories in which people with beards get an awful lot of ice in them. Julian, tell me a story about the Belgica, because I had never heard of it, and we know about the Erebus, and we know about the Terror, and we know about the Northwest Passage. It seems to have sort of slipped to one side of exploring history, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it's surprising, because it was the expedition that kicked off the so-called heroic age of Antarctic exploration. I think without the expedition of the Belgica, commanded by the Belgian sailor and naval lieutenant Adrien de Jarlèche, there might not have been... I mean, certainly everybody was racing to the Antarctic, but the nature of Antarctic exploration would have been different because there were a lot of lessons learned, both of what to do and probably more crucially of what not to do. I was surprised also that it hadn't been written about more extensively, and which is why when I first heard about it, I thought that, you know, there must be a book about this. I'd read an article in The New Yorker about NASA's plans for manned missions to Mars and how they were studying the effects of confinement and isolation in extreme environments on astronauts. And this is how I heard of the Belgica, because it began in classic New Yorker magazine fashion by backing into the story and writing three paragraphs about the Belgica expedition, which, as it happens, is still imparting lessons to people who are designing space travel because of, again, the what went wrong and what went right. And so in those three paragraphs, the story managed to bring an image of people going insane in the Antarctic. And that was, for me, that was just such an irresistible, almost horror movie premise. Something like out of Edgar Allan Poe or out of Coleridge, you know, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And then the fact that one of the heroes of the story was a man who later would be just maligned and turned seen as one of the great hucksters of American history, Frederick Cook, that such an anti-hero would turn out to be the hero of this expedition to the extent that there was one, I found so cinematic. And so I called a friend of mine who's a screenwriter out in L.A., and I said, you know, this is your next movie. It's ready made for a big hit. And he says, well, you know, in Hollywood, people don't make movies that aren't based on anything anymore. It's got to be based on some kind of IP. So maybe if there were a book. And so I looked, and I was not a particularly I knew about Shackleton. I knew about, you know, the expeditions you mentioned, but I didn't know about this one. And so I looked, and sure enough, there wasn't a book for certainly not in English or for the general reader about the Belgica. It was maybe at best one chapter in stories about Roald Amundsen as a sort of an origin myth for Roald Amundsen, but never in its own right. And it's just such a fascinating story.
Okay, well, can you start to ease into the story by sort of setting the scene? I mean, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that period of time, you know, not more than a century and a half ago, when there were places on the Earth where we simply didn't know what the hell was there.
Yeah.
And that seems to be really somehow behind it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in 1895, so this expedition left in 1897 from Antwerp. And in 1895, there was a convention of all of the major geographical societies of the Western world. And it was decided at that gathering that the most urgent priority of geographical societies and of exploration was the exploration of the Antarctic, which, as you say, was essentially a void at the bottom of world maps at that time. There were a few sketchy coastlines that had been charted, but beyond that, it wasn't even known whether it was a continent or whether, like the Arctic, it was a vast ocean of ice with a few scatterings of land around it. It was the ultimate geographical mystery, and it's remarkable that at the turn of the 20th century, such an area the size of North America, which is the Antarctic and the surrounding waters, was largely unknown. So this had been pronounced as the great priority of exploration, and the man who decided to heed that call was unexpectedly a rather inexperienced Belgian naval commander, the man I mentioned, Adrien de Jarlèche, And it was unexpected, not just because he was inexperienced, but because Belgium did not really have a maritime tradition to speak of. The only thing akin to exploration that they had done was the seizing of the Congo at the hands of Leopold II, who treated it as his personal fiefdom and ruled tyrannically over it. So there was no obvious connection between Belgium and seafaring exploration, or certainly not between Belgium and Antarctica.
And your sort of principal protagonist, the commander of the ship, what animated him? What actuated him? Because he does make it a scientific expedition, and there's, I can't remember who it is you quote, but there's one of the epigraphs has somebody saying, worse the effect that...
Mallory.
It's Mallory, yes.
Yeah, Mallory. It was the famous quote from Mallory is somebody asked him, why do you want to climb Mount Everest? And he said, because it's there. That was from a New York Times article, and I quoted from later on in the article what I thought was even more relevant is when he says, that expedition was also justified as a scientific one. And he said, he admitted, sometimes science is the excuse for exploration. I think it is rarely the reason. I put that there because it seems to perfectly describe de Jarlèche's motivations. He understood at that time that academia could excite the public, it could justify expeditions, it could raise funds for expeditions. And it was a time in the 19th century where, after having conquered much of the world, the Western powers were now competing to understand it. And so explorers were just as likely to be scientists like, or naturalists like Darwin or Alexander von Humboldt earlier in the century, as they were to be missionaries or soldiers or merchants or of governments. And so de Jarlèche was not a scientist himself. He was an intelligent man and an educated man, so he might have been curious about it. But he was smart enough to understand that this needed to be designed as a serious scientific expedition in order to justify the mission. But I think at the heart, it was certainly a romantic endeavor. This was not motivated by his desire to understand the mating cycles of penguins so much as it was for him to sort of relive the adventure stories that he read as a child.
And the way the expedition came together, which you describe, it's incredibly sort of scrappy, isn't it? I mean, he's pulling together people from here and there, and half of them are incompetent and half of them can't.
Yeah, no, if he had had his he wasn't a nationalist by any stretch, but he understood that in order to raise the funds that he needed, the best chance of doing that would be to present it as a national Belgian expedition. And yet, for all the excitement that there was at the beginning of this within Belgium, he was not able to assemble a fully Belgian crew. As I mentioned, there weren't that many Belgian sailors to speak of, and those that there were more likely to seek their fortune in the Congo, in the river system there. And the others, whoever would accept an assignment like this, were not the most reliable, disciplined bunch. They were a notch below pirates. So he had to fill out the ranks with more experienced sailors, and he had bought the Belgica in Norway. The first time he had any experience of navigation in the ice was aboard a whaling expedition in Norway. And it was then that he saw the Belgica and sort of fell in love with it. It was the runt of the Norwegian whaling fleet, a small, scrappy ship, as scrappy as the sailors that would populate it. But he fell in love, and so he eventually bought it. But in order to man this ship, half of the crew was Belgian, half of it was Norwegian. And the first mate, this was one of his most momentous and one of his rare, very, very good decisions. The first mate was Roald Amundsen, who at 26 was also pretty green, but it was clear to everyone, including to the Belgian consul in Sandefjord, Norway, that who insisted that de Jarlèche take him. It was pretty clear that he was destined to great things. He had already been fashioning himself as a modern-day Viking, and just his aura and his physical stature and his determination and his skill had already made his reputation as somebody who was destined to greatness. And he believed that more than anyone.
I mean, one of the sort of almost running jokes of this quite grim story is that the worse it gets, kind of the happier Amundsen is. You know, everybody else is like, shit, this is all going wrong. And Amundsen's always, I'm getting frostbite in my toes. Why don't I go for a walk to the top of that hill?
Yeah, this is incredible. I hope I get it in my fingers now. From the beginning, in his autobiography, he writes about the fact that what motivated him to pursue a life of polar exploration was the story of John Franklin, who was famously one of the led one of the most catastrophic expeditions to the Arctic, and was responsible for, well, I don't know how much you can blame him, but in any case, he suffered tremendously and died along with 130 of his men when the Terror and the Erebus were crushed in the ice of the Canadian Arctic. And so Amundsen took from this, he didn't see this as a cautionary tale. He saw it as inspiration. He said, what I admired most was the suffering, and I sought to emulate it. I think in his mind, it was partly masochism, but partly he's just, it's another form, another more ascetic form of the passion that drove de Gerlache. He equated suffering with accomplishment, that he was with progress. Not that he sought it for its own sake necessarily, but he thought that if in order to get somewhere, you needed to suffer.
Yes, I mean, that said, you put it very well, that says of a slightly different version of the same thing, that, you know, de Gerlache has this kind of romantic attraction to exploration. Amundsen, you know, something similar. And then there's your third man, Cook, your compatriot.
Yes.
Who also sort of effectively, like Amundsen, kind of writes in and says, oh, you know, can I come?
Yeah, and it was pure accident, or rather pure luck, that de Gerlache, or rather, luck is the wrong word. It was out of desperation. He had no other choice by that point, because he had three doctors accept an assignment on the Belgica, and then one was kicked out because his de Gerlache's father thought that this guy was essentially a Trojan horse for the Royal Belgian Geographic Society and that he would take control of the expedition. And then two other doctors begged off at the last moment, I think because they got cold feet, but they made up some excuse about how his sister was sick and he needed to take care of her. And this was the day of the departure. And so it was lucky in the sense that they left without a doctor. They left for the Antarctic without a doctor, you know, which was absolutely demented. What was lucky was that the first of many problems that would befall the Belgica happened that night when there was engine trouble and they had to go back to Belgium. And while the ship was being repaired, de Gerlache answered a telegram that he had gotten from Cook, an application from this unknown, or not unknown, it was a cold call.
At this stage, he was essentially a kind of family doctor in Yonkers.
He was a family doctor. He had been on a bunch of Arctic expeditions and had also, as a sideline to his medical practice, Cook also had done a series of lectures that were managed by the same impresario that managed tours for P.T. Barnum and Henry Morton Stanley, and even a young Winston Churchill. And so Cook was almost more of a showman than anything. And he would talk about his Arctic explorations, his time among the Inuit, and more importantly, he would talk about his plans for an Antarctic expedition, something that, as much as he trumpeted the possibility of finding gold and diamonds and in the Antarctic, as much as he teased the possibility of meeting native Antarctic people and exaggerated and lied, and, you know, he was an irresistible showman, but he was not necessarily particularly committed to the truth. And so as much as he did that, he was never able to get his Antarctic expedition off the ground. And when he heard in a newspaper that de Gerlache was about to embark for the Antarctic, he telegraphed him and said, I'm ready to command. I don't know why he said this, but he said, I've got 15 Eskimo dogs and I'm ready to command and to join the Belgica. And so de Gerlache had, I don't know whether he knew of Cook's unreliable reputation or whether he just thought, you know, I don't need another foreign crew member or foreign person on this ship. I'm already being criticized enough for this not being Belgian enough. And so he dismissed it. But when he had come back for the repairs, he had no other choice. It was, you know, this is a sign. I was about to leave with no doctor, and now I've got a chance to have a doctor, which is probably the most essential role, or certainly one of the most essential roles aboard an expedition to the most remote and hostile environment on Earth. And so he said, yes, join us in Rio.
Yeah, and then they pick him up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Off they go. And even before they've got to the Antarctic, they're making what seem to be these kind of rookie errors. You know, they lose weeks to sort of running aground randomly, don't they?
I mean, some of them were not of their own making. The running aground, you know, they were navigating, yes, by low light in the Beagle Channel in Tierra del Fuego. But I think they were also relying on inaccurate charts. So somewhat of a rookie mistake, but understandable. And it was miraculous that they were able to, with the help of Fuegian natives, were able to get the ship back afloat. But some were a product of de Gerlache's shortcomings as a leader. There was, as I mentioned, the Belgians were an undisciplined bunch, the crew, not the officers who were extremely competent and dedicated, but the crew had several chaos agents among them, and their indiscipline was exacerbated by the ready availability of alcohol in Punta Arenas. And after 3 days of them just ignoring orders and going to town and painting it red, mutiny was afoot. Dzhokhar's authority had entirely broken down. At one point, he was confronted by one of these men who shook him down for money, drinking money. And when he came back, Dzhokhar wanted to reprimand him, but the guy basically took a gun to Dzhokhar's cabin. And it was an absolutely critical moment. Dzhokhar was able to summon the help of the Chilean port authority and had to call for help, which I don't know if that reinforced his leadership or if that undermined it even more. But it was very likely that the expedition would not even have reached Antarctica.
Now, when they finally make it out towards the Antarctic, this is a story in some ways of a heroic failure, isn't it?
Yes, in a way, although I think, I don't want to give away too much, but the fact that I had diaries to draw from, that not everybody died, the scientific bounty that they came back with was so voluminous that it took 40 years to sort through. So I wouldn't say that it was a failure in that sense. It was a failure in the sense that one of the main aims of the expedition was to reach the South Magnetic Pole. And because of the delays that we've discussed in South America, the grounding, the near mutiny, because of the fact that Dzhokhar had indulged his scientists in the Antarctic Peninsula and had spent, you know, 2 crucial weeks charting this previously undiscovered strait along the peninsula, because of all those delays, he set off for the other side of the Antarctic, where the magnetic pole was supposed to be, far too late. By the time he would have gotten there, the winter ice would have set in and staved off any attempt to get to the coast of Victoria Land. And so he was in a position where he was already worried about what the Belgian press was saying about the international makeup of the expedition, the fact that it wasn't exclusively Belgian. And he was very worried about having nothing to show for the first season of the expedition. So he's skirting the pack ice in the Bellingshausen Sea, and a storm in late February breaks up the pack ice, which had seemed impenetrable until that point. And it opened up leads, avenues to the south. Dzhokhar was at this critical juncture where he thought, either I go home empty-handed and risk not being able to achieve my aims, or I try my luck and see if I can get as far south as I can through this lead. And if I get caught, if the ice is the very high likelihood that we will get caught, will also ensure that we will become the first men to endure an Antarctic winter. And he must have known that the stories of expeditions that go well rarely are written about. You know, you mentioned the Erebus. Before the famous and catastrophic end of the Erebus and the Terror, the ships had been led by James Clark Ross, and who had discovered Victoria Land aboard them. And it was an expedition that had gone with nary a hitch. It had gone very well. He was a very able, capable commander. And he had trouble getting written about when he came home, because there was this notion that if there was no bloodshed, even the Gazette, which was the Admiralty's publication, was reluctant to write about it. And so I think Dzhokhar also knew that even if he didn't come home with a record or the attainment of the South Magnetic Pole, he would come home with a story which would be as valuable as any bounty he could get.
But he didn't make this decision completely in the open. I mean, in a way, the sort of moral turning point of this book.
Everyone was against it. And so that is the moral turning point. That is, it was a... He managed to secure an agreement between him and the captain, Georges Lecointe, who was very loyal and who probably understood the calculation, and also was driven by his own curiosity to go as far south as possible. In that sense, they also aligned with Amundsen, this idea that accomplishment comes with suffering. But the scientists were petrified. And rightly so. They had not signed on to this. Nobody had planned to spend a winter in the Antarctic.
And they're kind of lying to the crew at this stage, aren't they?
They were not only lying to the crew, they were falsifying the coordinates and giving them the sense that even once they'd been stuck and everybody thought that they were imprisoned for the rest of the winter, and they turned out to be right, Dzhirlash kept the fires going and telling them that as soon as a lead would open up, they would head north, and gave them the good news that the pack was drifting north. And in fact, those were falsified, those coordinates. And in fact, if he kept the engines running, it was only in order to go farther south. And it's remarkable because at some point they would have figured it out. You know, they would have known. Surely enough, they did. So imprisonment in the ice definitely started off on the wrong foot. And the fact that it wasn't intentional, I think, was a crucial factor in why it had such a profound psychological effect on the men. They felt they felt not only betrayed, but surprised and helpless.
Yeah, and tell me a bit about the psychological effects, because, you know, the kind of heart of the book, you know, as the title says, is it's to do with the business of being trapped in this place. I mean, they weren't always cold because they were sort of inside the ship, but, you know, they're in complete darkness for 3 or 4 months. And
even being inside the ship had its own psychological consequences. Confinement, seeing the same faces sitting across from you day after day. The feeling of claustrophobia. The men started to suffer not only physically, as scurvy took hold of them after, you know, 3 months of nutritional deficiencies, scurvy and likely beriberi disease and another vitamin deficiency, but mentally as well. They started showing signs of confusion, of vertigo, of hostility, and deep depression. This is where Cook shined, because even though he was a bit of the doctor, Frederick Cook, even though he was a bit of a, he had, let's say, con artist tendencies, he was also an extremely empathetic man, and he conducted regular psychological surveys of the men, of officers and crew alike, and gave them equal attention. And this is something that also has inspired future expedition leaders and, both in the Antarctic and in space exploration have taken inspiration from this, because he understood that the psychological factor, how crucial that was, and he was alarmed by the ship-wide decline in mental health. So he associated it, and now we see rightly, with the disappearance of the sun for almost 2 months of total darkness. And having spent time among the Inuit, he had possibly misinterpreted some of their folklore and some of their sense of metaphysics. But he believed from that experience that the sun is as essential to human life as it is to plant life, and that the human body can store sunlight, which is a dubious notion. But because of that, he invented light therapy aboard. Because he couldn't bring the Belgica to the sun, he brought the sun in some form to the Belgica by having the men stand naked in front of a roaring fire for hours at a time, or for an hour, several hours in a day. And sure enough, it did seem to have some beneficial effect on their psyche, on their morale. And whether that is... And that he's been credited with pioneering phototherapy, but whether he was able, the fire that they were staying in front of was able to emit the full spectrum light that is now used for phototherapy is doubtful. However, even if it was just a placebo effect, that's also something a remarkable accomplishment, that he was able to instill an atmosphere of high spirits despite the gloom that was surrounding the ship.
Yeah, also, he seems to have saved a lot of people by making them all eat penguin.
He did. There was also a great intuition of his, and also inspired by the Inuit. And I think the fact that this is something that makes him such a remarkable figure is that he was trained in Western medicine, and yet he repeatedly found more inspiration from his time among the indigenous people of the Arctic, in polar matters specifically, than he did from his education. And so, as you mentioned, he forced his shipmates to eat the fresh meat of penguins and seals. It was obvious to him that the men were suffering from scurvy. And he had noticed in his time in Greenland that the Inuit, despite eating almost exclusively fresh game, did not seem to suffer from scurvy. They had no access to fresh fruits and vegetables for much of the year, if ever. And yet they didn't show symptoms of scurvy. And so partly because there was no other, source of fresh food, but partly out of this notion that the Inuit were onto something, he forced his shipmates to eat penguin and seal. And surely enough, those who took his advice and ate it as raw as possible.
Amundsen obviously loved it.
Of course, right. Of course, Amundsen loved it. But anyway, they did better, and they saw as surely as water douses fire, the vitamin C in fresh meat, though there isn't much of it, there is some of it, started to reverse the effects of scurvy. It is funny, as you mentioned, the meat of penguins, to most people, to almost everybody on board, was one of the most revolting things they'd ever eaten, especially because since the cook had been kicked off in Punta Arenas, he was one of the mutineers, kitchen duties were entrusted to de Jolache's cabin boy, who was eager but an extremely incompetent cook. And more than that, he was ambitious. So he tried to make these elaborate meals involving penguin meat, and they were just inedible. But yes, Amundsen, as we mentioned, equated suffering with accomplishment. And in his diary, he says, this is the best meat you could possibly hope for. It's to the point where suffering is no longer even suffering because he sees it as some great empowering character building thing. He associates it with pleasure. So yeah, he loves the steaks and he eats them raw and probably relished the expression of disgust on his shipmate's face as he guzzled them down.
Yeah, it's a fascinating character, Amundsen. There's so much. I mean, I think what makes this book so gripping is the wealth of human detail. It's really well documented. I mean, where did you find all this stuff? What was available? Because we got cartoons, we got photographs, we've got diaries. Did they sort of all bring them back and lodge them with a museum or something?
No. I thought that one of the reasons the story hadn't been told is because there wasn't enough of a historical record or there weren't enough primary sources. And I was disabused of that notion pretty quickly. Of the 19 men who left South America for the Antarctic aboard the Belgica, about a dozen had kept some kind of day-to-day record. And so it was a historian's dream. You can use as many secondary sources as you want, but when you're writing about a ship that's isolated, that has no communication with the outer world, you're limited to what those men were writing. And I had a bounty of historical sources to draw from. Some, obviously, if it was only Cook, I wouldn't have been able to believe any of it. But because I was able to triangulate between Cook and Amundsen and de Jolache and some of the crew members, that created this multi-perspective, it was kind of a Rashomon type exercise to try to figure out who was who had the closest version to the truth. But no, they were I found them all over the place. You mentioned the cartoons. Those were drawn by one of my favorite characters on this expedition, the Romanian naturalist Emil Racoviță, and they are kept at the Norwegian National Library in Oslo. And as are the original version of Amundsen's diaries. I relied on a translation for that, but I did translate a few others, other Norwegian sources. There were reports by crew members there were also diaries from one of the crew members who died that somebody just told me. This was also a dream. I heard you're researching the Belgica. This has never been consulted before, and we just found this in our archives, but could you use this? And it was he's one of the most touching stories of the story of the death of this young beloved crew member, and this makes it even more heart-wrenching.
This Danko, because there was two.
He was Belgian. He was Belgian. If he did keep a diary, I didn't find it. But no, this is Vinka, who suffered a horrible accident before they even reached Antarctica. But through his diaries, you read his, it's easy for the stories of crew members to be minimized and to, typically the officers are the ones whose accounts are remembered. But he had such a lovely poetic voice. He was a fan of Ibsen. He was a fan of Beethoven. He equated for him, the music of tempests, the screeching of the wind in the rigging, and the roar of the ocean against the ship reminded him of the treble and the bass of Beethoven sonatas. And so, these are things you read in these diaries, and these men come alive, and it just makes their fates so much more poignant.
Did you travel? I mean, obviously, the last year and a half, it hasn't really been possible, but did you travel down to the Antarctic to sort of try and get a sense of the atmosphere?
I did. I went there in December 2018, so that's the austral summer. It was a glorious trip. I was lucky enough that the weather, which is always unreliable, permitted us to get to the exact stretch of the Antarctic Peninsula that is named after de Gerlache, that he and his men explored over those two blissful weeks before the ice set in the first few weeks of 1898. I had a friend who was an editor a magazine editor here that I really respect, and I told him that I was planning on going to Antarctica for this book, and he said, "Well, why? Why don't you just rely on the diaries? This isn't a travelogue. You're not writing in the first person." You know, he accused me of trying to just write off a business trip to the Antarctic, and he was partly right. But it was mostly that I figured in order to get the novelistic detail that I was striving for, if I were just to rely on those diaries, I would have misunderstood the Antarctic. I would have, you know, I would have filled in the picture myself with my imagination. And I'm no novelist, so I wanted to see and hear and smell it for myself. And I was baffled by the otherworldly, almost alien quality of this land. Also, I was struck. I was expecting that sort of clear, crystalline Antarctic air, and that it would just be so refreshing. And in fact, what struck me was much of the time the overwhelming stench of penguin rookeries, which reminded me of a dumpster full of seafood on a hot day. But then I was, once I'd been there, I was able to recognize these descriptions, and they became familiar to me. And as did the land itself. When I was when we were steaming down the Gerlache Strait, these vista after vista reminded me of Frederick Cook's photographs, which were beautiful. But it looked like the land hadn't changed at all in 120 years, save for the fact that if I had been just relying on the photos, I would have been describing an environment in black and white, and this was just far more polychromatic, from enchanting spectrums of blues and the pops of color from the red of gentoo penguins' beaks to the yellow and green of the lichen. But one thing that did strike me during that trip was that as much as it seems like the land has been untouched since, I went on a few outings with some scientists who had come along with us, and they were studying the water of the Gerlache Strait for salinity and phytoplankton populations. And what they found was sobering, that the increased flow of meltwater from the glaciers is now reducing the salinity of the water there, which is changing the composition of the phytoplankton, which means that the kind of phytoplankton that the krill like to eat is now thriving elsewhere, which means that the krill are thriving elsewhere, which means that they're going to drag likely the penguins that feed on them and the seals that feed on them and the whales, the entire ecosystem is now in flux, and it's absolutely alarming.
Speaking of flux, one of the things that probably people who don't know the terrain would think, right, there's a ship trapped in ice, it's just like a big lump of ice, but the ice is so much a kind of character in the story, and it's moving constantly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Rakovica, the cartoonist I mentioned, naturalist, the Romanian naturalist, describes it beautifully as a parody of terra firma. It's this idea that it looks very much like a desert, like a it almost looks like the distant icebergs look like the as reassuring as the spires of nearby towns, and yet what appears to be land and is composed entirely of water is unbelievably treacherous. One day if you leave the ship and stray far enough to the point where you don't see it anymore, that could be deadly, because everything could have shifted in the meantime, and you would likely not find it again. It would have drifted away, or what appears to be solid ground could actually be slush covered in snow. And this happened to de Gerlache when he was walking. He didn't know how to swim. One of these, it always baffles me when I hear of sailors who don't know how to swim, almost as out of superstition. But at one point, he had too much faith in the solidity of the ground and fell straight through, and Cook snatched him by his coat collar and saved him from a frigid bath when it was almost minus 30 outside. So, and yet it deceived in other ways. I mean, it not only is the ice constantly moving, not only is it the pressure, a constant threat, gripping the ship and squeezing it pressure ridges shooting out of nowhere and rising 20 feet in a matter of minutes. Not only is all that happening, but the Antarctic light is a trickster. It could seem there were fog bows and rainbows and sun dogs and moon dogs and parhelix circles and all these unbelievable sort of, you know, almost mythological occurrences that got some of the, even the atheists aboard to believe in God. And then there's the fact that, you know, if on an overcast day, what can seem like a mountain in the distance is something that you just walk a few feet and you stumble over, because those are the tricks that that Antarctic light plays. And then there's the mirages like a Fata Morgana, where that can make a distant iceberg look like almost a spaceship hovering over the horizon, and can invert icebergs or magnify them to the point where Dujrlash in his log, which I was also able to access thanks to his great-grandson, wrote that he thought he saw a distant city, and he thought he saw a lighthouse shining towards him. And that was nothing but an extremely elaborate mirage that, you know, it's like something out of Tolkien, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, we won't go into too much depth into, you know, how they or some of them escaped, though, God, an awful lot of good luck seems to have been involved. But
And ingenuity.
But I'm interested, like, a bit in the aftermath, in these relationships, because, you know, a lot of the action of the book psychologically is the shifting loyalties of your kind of quartet of leading men. You know, Amundsen gets very, very fed up for good reason. And, you know, do those relationships hold? Do they remain, you know, in what?
Partly they were these antagonisms were the result of the pressures, both psychological and literal, the pressure of of the ice. And yes, there was there were definitely some, they made peace afterwards. But, you know, you mentioned Amundsen. He quit the expedition when he was aboard. They were stuck in the ice. They were stuck with each other. There was nowhere else for him to go. And yet he quit the expedition. And so he was incensed that he had discovered that Dujrlash had signed a contract with the Royal Belgian Geographic Society, in which he promised that should both he and the captain, who were both Belgian, should they die, the command of the expedition would go to another Belgian, which means that they would have bypassed Amundsen, who by as first mate had every expectation to inherit command. When he discovered this, he just blew his top, and he confronted Dujrlash, and, you know, Amundsen's an intimidating man, and will brook no disrespect. So he quit. Of course, he says, "I'm no longer the first mate of this expedition. I am just a man among other men trying to survive, and will do what I can to help my shipmates survive." So he did afterwards receive a medal and accept a medal from King Leopold. And for a while, it seemed like he had let bygones be bygones and made peace with Dujrlash. But at the end of his life, Amundsen just had... as everybody knows, he reached the South Pole first. He blazed through the Northwest Passage, and it's even quite likely that he was the first man to the North Pole as well, which he reached by airship in the 20s. But much like Alexander, who, when he ran out of lands to conquer, wept, Amundsen ran out of records to achieve, and he raged. He turned on all of his enemies. He became paranoid, and even his closest allies thought that, you know, suggested that he had gone insane. And at that point, he wrote an autobiography called My Life as an Explorer, where he turned on all of his enemies, including Dujrlash, who he blamed. Even though he admired Dujrlash during that expedition, he lambasted him in this autobiography. The one person he never turned against was Frederick Cook. He learned everything from Frederick Cook and always credited him with saving the expedition and with his remarkably ingenious interventions on the ice. And even though Cook would go on to, you know, famously lie about reaching the North Pole, lie about reaching the summit of Denali, the tallest mountain in North America. Even though Cook landed in Leavenworth Penitentiary for 7 years for running a Ponzi scheme, Amundsen was the one person who never abandoned him, and in fact, the only person who visited him in prison.
Well, that's the really touching kind of, I mean, it's a sort of coda, but it's the prequel, and as you set it out in the story. Well, I mean, what do you think happened to Cook? I mean, what was going on psychologically with him? But, you know, he had every entitlement to glory and respect, and yet, you know, he kind of squandered his reputation on fraud.
I think part of it comes from his upbringing. He grew up extremely poor in Williamsburg. His mother worked in a sweatshop. You know, everybody in the family had to hustle for a living. He was the son of German immigrants. They lived in Williamsburg, which was not the haven of hipsterdom that it is now. It was a really sort of wretched slum. And he had to hustle as you know, and he learned how to he built a milk delivery empire at the age of 16 and cornered the Brooklyn market. He put himself through medical school just at the same time, almost never sleeping, and through his whole life he struggled, and then. I think at the same so that taught him to, you know, do whatever it takes to get success and reach fame. And so when that instinct was rewarded, when he became kind of a semi-celebrity on the lecture circuit, and it just encouraged those tendencies to exaggerate and to to bend the truth. And part of it is because of the nature of the exploration business. As I mentioned, stories are the main resource of exploration. And he had some success writing about the Belgica expedition. He wrote a fantastic book called Through the First Antarctic Night. And when that came out, he became a minor celebrity. He made a good amount of money from it. And so he realized that he could make more money writing about exploration than he could as a family doctor. And he realized that he could sell more books if he, you know, kind of twisted the truth. So that combined with his natural personality as a dreamer and an outside-the-box thinker, I think that's what led him to, you know, he would say that he's guilty only of optimism, that he may have believed that he got to the North Pole. He certainly, in running a Ponzi scheme, he believed that he was, you know, that it would all pay off for everybody who bought into it. But again, I think it's a product of his youth and his understanding that he had to hustle to make a living.
Well, Madhouse at the End of the Earth by Julian Sancton is out now. Julian, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. I very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.